Good morning, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Etc. webinar series. I hope that the really, really hot, muggy, horrible weather has abated a little bit where you are. It's moving out from here. But remember in January when there's ice and snow on the ground, remember this week, and let's not complain. I am Shoshana Bryan. I'm director of the JPC and your host. We have a very large audience today, especially midsummer. And we're thrilled and hope you keep sending that invitation to your friends. Remind your friends too, as you send them invitations, that all of the prior JPC webinars, that's 2.5 years worth of webinars, are on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. Our guest today is David Weinberg, a man who knows a lot about a lot of things, especially, but not only, the Abraham Accords and what the Gulf states are thinking. This is great stuff and really important. So I'm going to do the short form of our JPC introduction and leave most of the day to David. Jewish Policy Center is a 501c3 organization established in 1985 to provide perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policies by leading scholars, academics, and commentators. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, missile defense, and the legitimacy and Israel of the legitimacy and security of the state of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As you know, we do sit slightly to the right of center. We advocate for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. I'm going to hang that on a sign in our office. In this series of calls, we have been everywhere, from China and Taiwan to Israel, to Russia and Ukraine, to Armenia and Azerbaijan, to Turkey, to the Gulf states, to NATO and U.S. defense spending, and last week, a great program with Ilya Shapiro on the United States Supreme Court. Today, as I said, we have David Weinberg with us. David is a government relations and foreign affairs specialist based in Israel, having made Aliyah from Canada in 1990. His English is therefore impeccable, and he only has a slight Canadian accent. He is a senior fellow at the Jerusalem-based Kohelet Forum, specializing in diplomatic and defense affairs, and a research fellow at Habitchon Nisim, Israel's Defense and Security Forum. He is a defense, diplomatic, political, and Jewish world columnist for the Jerusalem Post and Israel Hayom. He is a prominent lecturer on public affairs, and he's also an accredited expert on Israeli and kosher wine, having studied enology at the London-based Wine and Spirit Education Trust, the world's leading institute for qualifying sommeliers. He was a senior advisor to then Prime Minister Natan Sharansky and a founding coordinator of the Global Forum Against Antisemitism in the Israeli Prime Minister's office. He has been spokesman for the Bessa Center, for the Herzliya Conference on Israel National Security, for Bar-Ilan University, and he was a founding vice president and fellow of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. He has spoken in Canada, in Israel, in the United States, and in Europe, in just about all the forums you would expect, and on international media, again, in all the columns and places that you would expect. He's also been quoted by the New York Times, one of the few pro-Israel people who are quoted in the New York Times these days. In his spare time, or maybe this is really his primary occupation, he conducts food and wine tours in Israel in partnership with Kosher Travelers Limited. And he writes about kosher wine from around the world. If someone doesn't ask you about this, David, I am going to ask you about it. Reminder, you all are on mute, but you do have a Q&A button. Please send us your questions. I'm watching. And now David Weinberg, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. And hello to all of you on this call. Just one bio correction before I begin. While I am proud of my Canadian background, I am U.S. born and a U.S. citizen as well. I currently hold 3 citizenships, with Israel being the third, and I know how to swim just in case. Now, what you all really want me to talk about is Israeli wines in the kosher wine world, but we'll save that for another time. I've been debating with myself for the last 10 days on how to evaluate and sum up Biden's recent visit to the Middle East. And how to assess it for you here as well. Do I assess the Biden visit from a US strategic perspective, from a US partisan political perspective, from Palestinian or Arab or specifically a Saudi perspective, or from an Israeli perspective? And I'll try to do a little bit of all the above, but starting with Israel's perspective, what I think is a broadly held Israeli perspective on the recent Biden visit to the Middle East. In short, it was a fine visit. Despite an unconscionable lack of clarity and commitment with regards to halting Iranian hegemonic ambitions in the region, and despite some very unhelpful remarks by Biden with regards to the Palestinians and several sops that he provided the Palestinians. I'll come back to that later. Nevertheless, I say it was a fine visit and even a favorable visit, and I'll tell you why I think so. In an era of growing radical, progressive discourse in the Democratic Party, in which Israel is a burden on its liberal conscience, if not an outlaw state or even an apartheid state, Joe Biden came as a Democratic president and reiterated what he called the bone deep connection of America to Israel. And he repeated that phrase twice, bone deep. And he even specifically repudiated the anti-Israel progressive discourse in an interview to Israeli TV. He was asked about it, and he said they're wrong, referring to the radical liberal progressives in his party. They're wrong. Israel is our ally. And therefore, this is not something that I think we can, you know, just slug off or ignore. Again, Israel had low expectations from this visit, both on the Iranian issue and on the Palestinian issue. So what Biden did was general maintenance of the old school pro-Israel line of the Democratic Party, and that is important. The Jerusalem Declaration that Israel signed, that Prime Minister Lapid signed with President Biden, is a fine piece of diplomatic commitment to Israel on security, diplomatic, technology, economy, trade matters. It reiterates American commitment to renew the $38 billion aid package that the U.S. has extended Israel over a decade. It runs out in 2029, and he reiterated America's commitment to renew that before we get to the deadline. So that's a big deal for Israel, and not something to be taken for granted. Again, the Jerusalem Declaration contains nothing dramatic. No new major policy coordination on Iran, no substantive upgrading of the strategic partnership, but the lack of something meta-strategic doesn't render the visit wasteful, in my view. Now, I think we also have to add that compared to Obama's rhetoric when he came to Israel, where he hectored Israel constantly on the Palestinian issue, Biden's remarks about his continued commitment to the two-state solution as his preferred solution were relatively harmless. And that's how it was viewed widely here. Of course, compared to Trump, Biden's visit was a grand disappointment. Trump visited the Western Wall. He talked about the Jewish people's historic ties to the land of Israel. He went to Saudi Arabia and lectured Arab states, demanded that they halt their commitment to Islamic radicalism and reconcile with Israel. And then later, as you all know, he pulled out of the JCPOA, assassinated Qasem Soleimani, recognized Israel's control of the Golan and the legitimacy of settlements, and he moved the embassy to Jerusalem, and he closed the PLO office in Jerusalem, and he cut off funding to UNRWA, whereas Biden, by contrast, did not lecture the Arab states, certainly not publicly. And from diplomatic reports, doesn't seem that he did. He gave only symbolic expressions of mild support for the Abraham Accords, finally mouthing the words, the Abraham Accords, after refusing to even use those words for close to 2 years. He returned America funding and expanded America's funding of UNRWA. He gave more funding to the Palestinian Authority, or at least to institutions in the Palestinian Authority and to Palestinian institutions in Eastern Jerusalem. And of course, he did not visit the Western Wall, which could have easily have done, since an American president has already done it. And when he went to East Jerusalem, he went without an Israeli flag and without Israeli accompaniment. And I'll come back to this, his speech in Bethlehem was absolutely terrible. And then, of course, there's Iran. And he left the Iranian issue in a state of limbo, a state of limbo where there's no deal. And Iran's nuclear project is galloping forward. And that's a dangerous situation for Israel. Iran can become a nuclear threshold state without violating what, without triggering an American response, because Biden committed America to preventing Iran from holding nuclear weapons. But countries that are nuclear threshold states are generally considered to already be a nuclear power. That's how Israel will be forced to view Iran the minute it stands on the threshold of developing a bomb. And such a reality for Israel will be intolerable. It will become a Middle East mired in a nuclear arms race. And we have clear clarity about that. The fact that Biden left the issue unclear leaves us in a difficult situation. Now, before Biden came back at the beginning of June, I wrote a column called Why Bother? Why should Biden bother coming to the Middle East? What agenda does he have, I asked that time, that will be useful in the greater scheme of things and welcomed by regional leaders? Does he have a credible vision for tackling the real problems of this region, beginning with Iran? And you know, the signals coming from Washington throughout the almost 2 years of this administration on Iran have been the wrong signals. Just before he came, Yael Lampert of the administration, she's the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. She gave a speech in Washington and tried to convince America's allies that it's not abandoning the Middle East and put climate change and human rights at the top of America's priority for the Middle East as well. It's the wrong type of messaging for Israelis, Saudis, and other parties in the region. So I asked, you know, is he coming to preen about his diplomatic pressure that he's applying to Iran, which doesn't seem to amount to much? Is he coming to broker a sulha between the Saudis and the Qataris? Is he coming to lecture Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS of Saudi Arabia, about human rights, or President Sisi of Egypt, for that matter? Is he coming to praise Abbas, which he did? Is he coming to coddle the Palestinians and reopen a U.S. consulate in Eastern Jerusalem, which America is apparently still committed to, but hasn't done so? And I also worried that he was coming to impose new arrangements on the Temple Mount, where new pro-Jordanian and basically detrimental to Israel arrangements on the Temple Mount to curtail the already scaled back is minimal Israeli security control and national religious rights on the Temple Mount. And I warned at that time that Israel should torpedo any such initiative even before Air Force One takes off from Andrews Air Force Base. Biden, in the end, stayed away from these issues, at least in his public remarks. And therefore, from an Israeli perspective, the fact that he reiterated traditional mainstream democratic pro-Israel support from Israel and repudiated the radical progressive discourse has value. from Israel's perspective. Now, Biden came anyway. He didn't listen to me when I said, why bother coming? And he did so probably to partially make amends with the Saudis and get their cooperation in oil supplies. That's what most analysts and pundits around the world have said. And perhaps he was trying to outflank the Chinese and the Russians in their forays into the Middle East. Did he achieve this? Frankly, we don't know. Certainly there were no announcements with the Saudis or the any other Arab leaders with which Biden met that would indicate so. And therefore it would seem that his visit fell flat. But from Israel's perspective, any U.S.-Saudi reconciliation is welcome. Now, let me repeat that because it's a wild statement. As an Israeli and as an Israeli analyst, I'm saying that any U.S.-Saudi reconciliation is a welcome development. That's how much the sands have shifted in the Middle East, because Israel and Saudi Arabia are essentially in the same camp, a camp of the anti-Iran camp, and a partial return of some sort of the U.S. to that camp is welcome from Israel's perspective. I want to add two more points before concluding my assessment. One relates to Biden's speech in Bethlehem, and the other relates to internal Israeli politics, domestic Israeli politics, and how it impacts on all this. You, Shoshana, I believe, wrote a piece recently that was headlined, Biden Stumbled at the Finish Line. And by the finish line, you meant his last day here, which was his day with Mahmoud Abbas. And he stood next to Mahmoud Abbas in Bethlehem, and he gave an absolutely terrible speech. Again, in the Israeli media, people didn't pay close attention to it because it was almost an after the fact. The grand drama of the visit to Israel was over, and who cares what Biden has to say when he stands next to Abbas in Bethlehem. But I think that's a mistake because it was a terrible speech. He used language in there that I'm not sure we've heard from American presidents before, and certainly we haven't heard it since the days of Obama. He talked about the solution being a two-state solution on the 67 lines with land swaps. That moves America very close to the European consensus. Talking about 67 lines is not helpful. He also talked about a contiguous Palestinian state, which is simply not feasible and will never happen given the realities of the last 50 years. Worse still, in my mind, is that he talked about Jordanian jurisdiction. Note that word, jurisdiction, over holy sites in eastern Jerusalem. Jordan has no jurisdiction. That's a word the Jordanians made up and have been pumping intensively over the last 2 years. Biden used it when King Abdullah visited him in the White House last year. And even then, Israel protested. In the Israel-Jordanian peace treaty of a number of years ago, Israel did recognize a special role, quote unquote, a special role for Jordan in the holy sites in Jerusalem. That's not jurisdiction. Jordan and no other country has jurisdiction over any site, holy or otherwise, Christian, Muslim, or otherwise in Jerusalem. And that's objectionable language from Israel's perspective. It does undermine Israeli sovereignty in eastern Jerusalem. And that's very problematic. And furthermore, and I think you pointed out this as well, Shoshana, Biden made a comparison to Ireland. And using his Irish background, as if Jews are British Anglican colonialists and the Palestinians are Irish oppressed Irish Catholics. you know, he likes to personalize things, Biden, and make it chummy and talk about his background. And in Israel, he talked about his father and how his father talked about how the Jews were abandoned in the Holocaust and how meaningful that was for him. And maybe he was trying to say something about his personal background when he was on the Palestinian side as well. But that's a very problematic statement because, again, it creates a colonial oppressor paradigm for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I think this speech will come back to haunt us. My final point before we open this up for discussion, as I said, relates to the internal Israeli situation, which can be viewed as, and I'm worried, it could be viewed by regional actors as strategic weakness. Israel's been forced into 5 elections in the last 3 years. November 1st will be Israel's 5th election. And if Israel's not viewed as having clear and strong diplomatic, political, strategic leadership, the new regional alliances that Israel has been blessed with could begin to fray. After all, the perception of Israeli strength and diplomatic prowess was the key to the Abraham Accord alliances. I've heard from my own contacts in the Gulf, and I've been to Dubai and Abu Dhabi now several times and had real deep conversations with their strategic thinker community. They came to this because they viewed Israel as strong in every way, as a strong society, as a strong polity, as a strong nation with deep historical and religious and ethnic roots, strong militarily, strong in terms of its intelligence powers, strong economically and technologically. And if they see Israel weakening from within, these alliances could weaken as well. I think Prime Minister Bennett did a fine job of replacing Netanyahu in this regard and projecting regional strength. He actually increased Israel's pinpoint strikes on Iranian targets in the region, in Syria and beyond Syria. I'm doubtful that interim Prime Minister Lapid is projecting and can project the same type of strength. Look at how President Putin of Russia is beating up on Israel right now on a completely different issue, an issue relating to Jews in Russia and the Jewish agency's ability to operate in Russia. This is a clear slap down to Israel. He's punishing Israel for Yair Lapid's statements with regards to the Russian-Ukraine conflict. And I'm not sure how consistent and powerful a regional actor Lapid is viewed by our new regional partners. And that worries me because, as I say again, a perception that Israel is being weakened from within or torn apart from within and unable to hold the government together for a substantial period of time can weaken our regional alliances as well. So that remains a certain cloud that in my mind hangs over the situation. And it's not a good situation to be in when the confrontation with Iran may yet be coming sooner than we expect. So I'll stop there. Thank you for listening to me and be glad to take your questions. Shoshana?
And we have questions. So you and I had a short conversation before, and I want you to talk about this for our listeners. I said to you that it seemed to me the Gulf states have begun to assert their own political and strategic interests. There was a letter written before the president's visit, kind of warning the president. It was a researcher from UAE who said the Gulf states have their own geopolitical interests and considerations, including their aspiration to deepen and expand ties with other world powers. I said to you, like Russia and China, right? And you said to me, yes, but. Would you talk about the but and Iran?
Right. So the bot is Iran. Let's take a step back. I said earlier that the perception of Israeli strength was what brought Abraham Accord countries to bandwagon together with Israel. They want to be on the winning side of conflicts in the region. They're afraid of Iran. And if Israel or America are projecting strength and intend to come out on the winning side of this grand regional strategic conflict, they're happy to partner with the US and Israel because they want to be on the winning side. If regional countries become convinced that Iran is going to win the regional strategic struggle, they will move to bandwagon with Iran. And you already see the Saudis and the Emiratis hedging their bets somewhat by inviting China into strategic partnerships and by conducting what have been until now low-level talks, but nevertheless talks with Iranian leaders over the past year, something that wasn't the case at all over the last 10 years, not to mention Qatar. So they are hedging their bets at the moment, still betting on Israel and hoping that they can bet on America, but not seeing it at the moment. Biden made clear that America is still seeking a renewed diplomatic deal with the Iranians based on the JCPOA of 2015, which at the time was viewed as a bad deal from the regional Arab perspective and, of course, Israel's perspective. And today would be even worse deal if America were to return to that because the Iranians have advanced so far ahead. And therefore, I think it's correct, the statement that you quoted, that the Arab states are out to protect their own interests. And you see that the Saudis seem to have stiffed Biden in his requests related to renewing or expanding, you know, the oil supply for the West significantly. Most indications are that they said to him in their private conversations, fine, but pay up. Let's see your renewed support for ABCDs, you know, stop beating up on us with regards to human rights, stop beating up on us with regards to the war in Yemen, a whole series of other issues. So Washington is going to have to work a lot harder to buy renewed trust, both in Israel and in the Gulf states.
And excuse me, the visit of Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, to the Arab League meeting, and the photographs, there were lots of photographs of Lavrov shaking hands with Arab representatives, which we understand on this side, the White House did not want the Arabs to do, but they did it anyway. So the Russians are making some inroads, I think, in a place that we didn't used to think they were, which is with the conservative Arabs. How do you see it?
I think Israel's conservative Arab allies in the Gulf, and that includes Egypt as well, know to be cautious of the Russians. They're playing a game. They're hedging their bets, as I mentioned earlier. But I don't see them jumping into an embrace of Russia, not when Putin has made himself into so much of a pariah internationally. The Russians don't have a lot to offer them either, not in terms of access to Western markets, not in terms of technology. They don't need Russian gas and oil. They know that Russia has used its air force effectively in Syria in order to prop up its ally there, Assad. But that doesn't mean that Russia is a great strategic partner for Saudi Arabia or any other Gulf states. And I think they're playing a game now, but I don't think that Israel's worried that the Saudis are going to jump into bed with the Russians in a significant way.
Okay, so you mentioned the Russian Air Force in Syria. Here's a question about the Jewish Agency. So the Russians have clearly made it impossible for the Jewish Agency to work there. They've leveled a series of charges and have upset the relationship greatly. However, they have not yet touched, as I understand it, the deconfliction arrangements with Israel over Syria. Have they chosen to look at the Jewish Agency, chosen to look at Moscow, instead of saying to the Israelis, if we don't like your position on Ukraine, we're going to stop deconflicting with you, and maybe we'll even attack your planes as you attack Syria? So far, Israel's had free rein in Syria with Russian permission and agreement.
That's generally true. And as far as I know, that remains the case. But the truth is, I don't know. You don't know. Most of us really don't know how well and smooth the deconfliction arrangements in Syria are working at the moment. It does appear that Putin has chosen to fire a warning shot across Israel's bow, using the Jewish Agency and Russian Jewish immigration issue, and not touching the deconfliction mechanism. But I don't know. I'm not sure, and I don't know if that's going to change 2 hours from now, or changed already 2 hours ago. It's not something that Israel obviously would want to broadcast, but it remains a real concern. Remains a real concern. The main reason that one assumes that Putin will not tinker with the deconfliction mechanism is because that Russia shares an interest with Israel in not letting the Iranians go too far. And while Iran served a useful purpose, it sent lots of militia forces to be the ground troops that complement the activity of the Russian Air Force on Assad's behalf. We don't believe, Israeli analysts don't believe, that Russia's interested in seeing frontline Iranian troops on the Israeli-Syrian border. And in that regard, as long as Israel is careful to target only Iranian IRGC and Iranian-backed militia targets in Syria and in Iraq, and not Russian or Syrian regime targets, the Russians are happy to go along with that. I hope that stays the case.
Hope so, too. So everything circles back in the end to Iran. I mean, everything you look at, it circles back to Iran. So if we're going to circle back to Iran, they are a threshold state, which some people think is not terribly threatening. That is not your view, clearly. It's a threat. Do you see anything short of preemptive war taking that threat off the table? Because there's a follow-up question to that.
Right. Listen, if the United States of America openly and publicly and decisively built a credible military threat and was seen to be exercising it, exercising for it, and combined that with renewed economic sanctions on the Iranian regime and all of its senior officials, including the IRGC, there are analysts who believe that Iran would get the message and would dial back, I don't know, for the next decade, its efforts, and even agree to mothball much of its nuclear enrichment infrastructure under IAEA safeguards once again. On the other hand, there are analysts who believe that even that won't do it. And it's sort of a moot question because this administration doesn't seem to be building momentum towards either a new serious regime of sanctions or an open declared credible military threat, nor does it seem to be willing to provide Israel with everything that Israel needs in order to wield a fully credible military threat against the Iranians. So we may get there. To a state where Israel feels the time has come for it to act. It will be very hard for Israel to survive diplomatically a direct attack on Iran without an American green light, an American backing after the fact. It'll be very hard to stop the Iranians from rebuilding as swiftly as they can after an attack, unless it is so deep penetrating and decapitating that there'll be no desire to do so in Iran. And it's hard to see how Israel has the wherewithal to do that on its own. So we're in a real quandary.
And yet, both the defense minister, Benny Gantz, and the IDF chief of staff, General Kochavi, have said publicly that Israel will not permit Iran to acquire nuclear weapons. Are they trying to prepare the Israeli public? Are they trying to gin up support at home or reassure people? What's going on if, in fact, it would be really hard to do without American support, which they don't have?
I think they're trying to build both to strengthen the Israeli consensus that if push comes to shove, Israel will act. I know that the military is engaged in very deep and serious preparations for a strike on Iranian targets in Iran if push comes to shove. I don't know whether it's true or not that Netanyahu sort of put this such planning aside in the last several years of his tenure. That's an accusation that Prime Minister Bennett made very directly. But it is clear that the military is certainly engaged in that now and received a tremendous amount of additional budget in the Bennett budget for this purpose. And yes, they're clearly, with Gantz and Kochavi speaking this way, they're clearly trying to influence Western policy. I don't think it's an empty threat, but it will be very difficult for Israel, not just operationally, but diplomatically, to go on its own.
So we have heard that should Israel take this step by itself, or even, I guess, if they take it with the United States, there will be direct retaliation, most likely from Hezbollah, rockets and missiles on Israel. How do you think Israel is preparing to deal with that kind of possibility?
You know what Chekhov said about, I think it was Chekhov, about the gun that you see in act one of a play will certainly go off in act three. That is an accurate description of Hezbollah's rocket and missile capacity, which ranges anywhere from the 100 to 160,000 rockets and missiles, depending on which assessment you follow, with several thousand of those being what Israel considers to be precision-guided missiles. In fact, much of the interdictions of weaponry that in Syria and Lebanon that Israel has taken over recent years is to prevent the shipment of precision munition kits from Iran to Hezbollah, allowing them to upgrade their weaponry. Those missiles will one day be fired at Israel, whether it's in the context of an Israel-Hezbollah conflict or a broader, more likely in the context of a broader Israeli-Iranian conflict, and Israel will be hurt. All our various levels of Iron Dome air defense missile systems Iron Dome, of course, is a relatively short range system. And there's David Sling, and there are other missile systems. We'll interdict X number of incoming missiles, but one assumes, one has to assume that in the next significant war, the Israeli home front will be hit hard. Is the Israeli home front ready for that? And the home front means both civilians as well as critical civilian infrastructures, airports, railroads, power plants, petrochemical facilities, major highways, and so on. It's not going to be neat or clean. And I go back to your question beforehand, but Gantz and Kochavi are prepared, the Israeli public, for a reality where war is not a an unthinkable possibility, where we live in the part of the world where there's at least one major strategic actor with hegemonic ambitions to strangulate Israel. One day, in one way or another, that conflict may erupt, and Israel will win, but it will pay a price.
I think it's one of the real differences between the United States and Israel. Each generation of the Israeli military has had to face the possibility of defending the homeland, defending its parents, defending its kids on our soil, on their soil, where we tend to see our military as outward looking and defending us from abroad and defending people abroad. I think that's a major difference in the way our societies see international affairs and international threats.
Just earlier today, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah issued very specific and focused threats against Israel's natural gas rigs in the Mediterranean. There's a dispute over a maritime border and some natural gas fields that straddle the Israel-Lebanon maritime border. And of course, Lebanon is a wholly owned Hezbollah entity today, or nearly wholly owned. Hezbollah issued a very focused warning of its ability to strike within the next 2 months. Israel's gas rigs, that would lead to a fuller-scale Israel-Hezbollah war. I don't think it would be contained. It would require Israel to respond with disproportionate force. And I tell everybody who comes to visit here that disproportionate force is not just legal, but it is moral and it is strategically logical. Don't expect to Israel to respond proportionately. There's a great segment from the West Wing. I'm sure you've seen it. It's on YouTube, where President Bartlet screams at his generals when they propose a proportional response to some terrorist incident. He screams at them, "I don't want a proportional response. Who says that we have to be limited to a proportional response? Our enemies need to know that our response will be wildly disproportional."
And you have to say it at the same time, because people say, well, that's criminal, that's a war crime. No, it's not. It's not. The law of war is very clear on these things. And I write about it periodically. You do as well. That proportionality in terms of casualties, it's not what people think it is. And I suspect that before the next war, God forbid the next war comes, that before the next war, people ought to read up on what the rules are. We're running out of time. Sideways. An Israeli reporter in Saudi Arabia went to Mecca. It is against Saudi law. It is against their rules for their city. And I understand that a Saudi citizen who helped him get there has been arrested. What do you think should happen to the guy? The journalist, not the Saudi citizen.
I think there's a consensus here that the journalist made a mistake. I don't like the fact that non-Muslims are barred from Mecca and Medina, but that is their policy, and it should be respected. And this was a childish and somewhat rash He's been wildly criticized by Israeli leadership, by Israeli media leadership, and in the press here. And I assume that his career will advance a little less quickly than he had hoped. It was a mistake. Jonathan Tobin wrote a very important column the other day in which he rejected comparisons to between this incident and the Israeli desire for prayer on the Temple Mount. No comparison. Temple Mount is holy ground to Jews, not just to Muslims, and any such comparison should be rejected. But the same way that the Israeli attempt to assassinate Hamas leader Mavhuch in Dubai some 10 years ago setback Israeli Emirati relations for a good 2 years, incidents like this, could set back Israeli Saudi relations. Of course, that was an Israeli government operation. This was a gimmick of a lone journalist, so we can't make that comparison either. But as we say in Hebrew, chaval, too bad. It shouldn't have happened.
Was too bad. Okay, so last question. People who listen know that the last question I ask is one to which our guest has to have a positive answer. So, because I like to leave on that note. Somebody did write in a question, though, that says, judging by your recent Jerusalem Post columns, you are more optimistic about the Israeli body politic, regardless of its electoral instability, than many other commentators. What is the source of your optimism?
Israel is a healthy society. Been poisoned by radical political rhetoric, by the debate over Netanyahu. Yes, Netanyahu. No, Netanyahu. But it's a healthy society with a young population, an enthusiastic population, a growing economy, and an optimistic, happy people. Moreover, on the major foreign policy and defense issues, there is little disagreement. Nobody in Israel believes that Palestinian statehood is at least not a near-term solution. Nobody believes that we should go soft on our opposition to Iranian hegemonic ambitions or its nuclear program. And the fact is that there was little policy difference between the Netanyahu administration and the Bennett administration. And if we have a Lapid administration, it'll be much the same. On the major issues, Israelis are not divided today. Yes, we fight about issues of religion and state and conversion and kashrut. We fight over the toxicity of Netanyahu. But compared to the poisonous political atmosphere that you have in the U.S. today, we're one big happy society. So in relative terms, I am optimistic about the future of both Israeli society and our political system.
David Weinberg, that is a great note upon which to end, a great optimistic note upon which to end. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for giving us your perspective. It's different than ours. We need it. We need to talk to people in Israel who watch what we watch and see things that we don't see. Thank you again, everybody. We'll be back next week.